flu. Anthony Lee flu has been referred to as perhaps this century's, if not the most famous and prominent, atheist philosopher of all time. Anthony Flew has been very active in debating Christians and theists all over the world. He's a British philosopher. In terms of his philosophy, it's a lot like Bertrand Russell, and there's been a lot of debate over who was the more prominent or gifted atheist philosopher. Was it Bertrand Russell or Anthony Flew? Most people give the nod to Anthony Flew, mainly because he lived later and had to deal with more challenging issues than Bertrand Russell had to deal with. And I find it interesting that this news story was released in Buffalo. This is in the Buffalo News. And Buffalo is probably the most, it's kind of the center of atheist evangelism here in the United States. I've been to Buffalo myself, and indeed there are numerous atheists there. It's the location of Prometheus Press, which is the main press for atheist literature. And this story got leaked. The story was going to be released at Biola. And Gary Habermas, who has debated Anthony Flew frequently, had the privilege of being the first one to interview Anthony Flew after he turned from an atheistic position to a theistic position. And he's got this long interview, it was going to be released, but the newspapers caught wind of the story and kind of released their story. Therefore, what's happened is that Gary Habermas has decided to put his interview up on the Internet in advance of publication. So you can read it. I've read it myself. It's a long interview. Gary and Anthony have been on friendly terms with one another in spite of the fact that they've debated one another for the past 20 years. Now, Anthony Flew has not become a Christian. He's become a theist. And he explains in the interview, by the way, what you see here is just a brief statement of the change in Anthony Flew's theological position. And here he describes himself as a deist, much like Thomas Jefferson. Although when you read the interview between Gary Habermas and Anthony Flew, to me, he's much more close to between a theistic position and a deistic position. He did concede in the interview with Gary Habermas that there very likely is substantial evidence for historical miracles that are recorded in the Bible. But what I found interesting is that what shows up in the interview, Gary just asked him, what was it that persuaded you to abandon atheism and adopt some kind of deistic theism? And he named three things. He said the origin of the universe and Big Bang cosmology, the origin of life, and the anthropic principle. And then Gary said, well, was there anything else that played a role? He says, no, that's basically it. He says, I can't say it was philosophical arguments that persuaded me. He says, I've never been persuaded by the arguments coming out of the Christian Philosophical Society concerning the column cosmological argument. Never felt that was persuasive. But he says, what really persuaded me was the scientific evidence. Then Gary had the wisdom to ask him a follow-up question. He said, what do you think would have happened to Bertrand Russell if he had saw the same evidences that you've seen? And he says, without any doubt, Bertrand Russell would have become a theist, because this was the big barrier in Bertrand Russell's life, the lack of scientific support for a theistic position. Gary, I thought, was very good in pointing out there's always been scientific evidence for the God of the Bible, but the thing that Anthony Flew kept pointing out, it's only been in the last 20 years that the scientific evidence has become so utterly persuasive, and this is something that was missing 50, 60 years ago. And he tries to argue, which of these three, and he says it's a combination of the three. He says with the Big Bang cosmology, you've got this beginning of space and time. There must be some kind of causal agent beyond that. The origin of life, he says, cannot possibly be explained by naturalistic pathways. And then he said, very persuasive is the fact that we see this overwhelming evidence for design in the universe and the solar system that makes life possible. Gary also turned the conversation around to the miracles of Jesus, and he said, I haven't really looked at that in any great depth. Gary and Anthony are famous for debating the evidence for the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And what Anthony is now admitting is he finds that evidence much more persuasive now that he realizes there is indeed a God. However, it's the ministry of Jesus that still gets in the way. And because, you know, Gary asked him a follow-up question, well, what is it that prevents you from going from your position of deistic theism all the way to Christianity? And he said, the problem of evil. It's the problem of evil. He says, I've never felt that the moral argument for the existence of God was compelling. You know, he knew C.S. Lewis. This guy is 81, so he knew C.S. Lewis quite well. But he said C.S. Lewis's arguments for God never persuaded him. And, you know, C.S. Lewis used two arguments, the ontological argument and the moral argument. And Anthony Flew says, to this day, he does not find those arguments at all compelling. But he says, the science is really what compels me. But given how compelling the science is, he says, he's willing to re-examine the evidence for the miracles that took place in the life of Jesus. But he says, what really bothers me about the person of Jesus is the message he preached of heaven and hell and morality. And it's, you know, this guy's British. And I've noticed, having been to Britain myself, that the problem of evil takes on a completely different dimension in Britain than it does here, mainly because the abuses of the church are so out in front of people, particularly within the Anglican and Roman Catholic denominations. That seems to be a major barrier. And just like a number of scientists I've met that are from Britain, it's not so much the rebelling against the God of the Bible, they're rebelling against their church upbringing. And, you know, they hate Anglicans, they hate Roman Catholics, they don't necessarily hate God. So I think Anthony Flew is still kind of in that position. But he feels that Christians are offering a really weak response to the whole problem of evil. He says, you know, the Muslims have it down. He says, it doesn't bother them that God is evil. But he says, with Christians, you know, their God is supposed to be a God of love. So he says, for Christians, this really is a particular problem. Although he made it quite clear in the interview that he says, if I were to compare Islam to Christianity, there's no question that Christianity is by far the superior religion. Because he says, what he sees in Islam is this whole idea, you know, God doesn't care. God you know, knows that there's evil out there, doesn't do anything about it, and it's all fatalism, and God justifies the use of evil to promote his ends in Islam. He says, I recognize that Christianity does not have that perspective. On the other hand, he says, I don't think Christians have any real good answer to the problem of evil. Now, in saying all that, we need to recognize that Anthony Flew is still operating from what I would call a one-creation model. You know, his idea is that what Christians are promoting is this concept that we were created in paradise and that God's in business of restoring us to that paradisical state. And it does concern me that a number of denominations today are promoting that kind of eschatology, that theology of the end. And I think what could be a breakthrough for Anthony Flew is to recognize that Christian theology is not God restoring us to paradise, but delivering us from paradise to a far superior state. In that context, the evil that we now experience does have an ultimate good purpose. In fact, the Bible says it not only has an ultimate good purpose, it has a present good purpose. And but I recognize that I don't think Christians have done a really good job of presenting that perspective to Anthony Flew. I encourage you to pray for him. Because I've noticed that other prominent atheists, when they move from atheism to deism or theism, often that's the beginning of a journey. Now, the guy's 81. I would pray that he would complete his journey before his days are out. Yes. Right. Well, I noticed that too, that the media is kind of downplaying this whole thing. I mean, you would think this would be major news in any secular context. Yep, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there really is no more famous atheist of our day than Anthony Flew. And, you know, look what happened to him, and yet this is being buried. I went on the internet like you did, Ross, and the only way I could find a story on it was by putting in the name Anthony Flew. And even then I had to scroll a long ways down before I found the story. And yet, you know, it was the most current thing on Anthony Flew, but it had all of this old stuff up there. So that is interesting. So, but yeah, this is a big story. By the way, we are going to attempt to interview him on Creation Update. Now, I'm a little bit concerned because my guess is Christians are going to just bombard this guy, and we don't want him to feel bombarded. But, you know, we've had a track record for the past 3 years of interviewing the most prominent leaders on the whole spectrum of creation evolution. So I think this would fit right in, and hopefully he'll be comfortable being interviewed by us, and maybe we'll have a chance to just get his comments on what he thinks about our model for the problem of evil. You know, I'm kind of grateful that now we got that whole thing in the can. We just finished our last episode on the problem of evil. So, yes. Well, that's something that Gary Habermas did bring up in his interview. He says, you know, we've been talking all this time about how Christians don't have a good answer to the problem of evil. What do you think about the problem of good? And Anthony Flew admitted that that's probably a much more positive way to go for resolution on this issue. He says, yes, this is something my atheist peers have really failed to grapple with. How do you explain good in the world? So, I mean, that's something we do in our whole tape series on resolving the problem of evil, is just make the point that, number one, you can't explain evil unless there is a God. There's just way too much evil in the world for this to be blamed on Darwinian principles or the laws of thermodynamics. And number two, you can't explain good. I think what's particularly pointed is that the people argue about natural evil and natural good, and frankly, I'm not comfortable with those terms, because I think when you get into the animal kingdom, you're merely seeing the outworking of the laws of physics. But when you look at the human species, there's a stark difference in the evil that and harm that we perpetrate and the good that we also exercise. So that would indicate another example why there's something special about human beings compared to all other animals. But yeah, it'd be neat if we could just get Anthony Flew to comment without any, you know, obvious attempt for us to argue with him, just to merely comment on what he thinks about our model and the problem of evil. Okay, I just wanted you to be aware of that. I mean, this is a great time. I mean, just before Christmas, this story breaks. And I've always found at Christmas time, when my non-Christian friends and relatives get together, it's always neat to be able to go after certain news stories that you can use to get discussion going about spiritual things. So that's why I decided to give you all a copy about that. And if you go on the web and type in Gary Habermas's name, you will be able to pull up this interview. It runs about, a dozen to 15 pages long. Yes. So Biola University homepage has it too? Okay. Biola.edu, we'll pull that up as well. Okay, something else I'm going to pass out to you. And did we have enough copies for all of these? Okay, because I only printed like 55 of them, but I printed 100 of these. So if you want to take more than one, you can take more than one, but try not to take two. Okay, yeah, you can have that one. Go ahead. Want to make sure I had one here. Well, you know, as many of you know, every day at Reasons to Believe, we post a new scientific discovery that gives additional weight of evidence for the God of the Bible and the Christian faith. And at the end of every year, Krista Bontrager asks us, we mean meaning Fuzz and myself, we're the two that create these new Reasons to Believe. She asked us to pick out 10 of what we think are the most significant discoveries of the past year. And I tried to do that, but I had a real hard time editing it down to 10. I'm going to try to talk her into letting us post 12 on the web rather than 10. That's one per month. And I noticed, too, that this is pretty well distributed throughout the months. I got a January one in here and a February one in here. And we really do cover kind of the whole year. And a Fuzz is also going to be producing a list. So what you see on the web will probably be just 10 or 12 of our two lists combined. But this is my list that I came up with. And I want to tell you, this is really difficult to do. And I may wind up editing this list after I leave this class. Because, when I got here, this is just a file folder of what I thought were the best scientific discoveries for 2004. And, you know, it's about 60 or 70 in here. Of the 300 that we posted, and I had to go through that and pick 12. And I might have to change this because there's some that I had to drop off that I wasn't too excited about dropping off. But I thought you'd just be interested in this. And again, this is something I'd encourage you to use in your personal witness this Christmas season. Find things in here. Sometimes people even bring these subjects up while you're talking to them. And I just try to give you kind of a one-sentence summary of what the discovery is all about and how it ties into the Christian faith. And by the way, if you want a little more detailed discussion on this, go to our website. We archive all of today's New Reasons to Believe. So you'll find every one of these discoveries archived on our reasons.org website. And there you can pull up a whole paragraph rather than just one sentence. Yes. On flubiola.edu, www.biola.edu. Is it Biola University or just Biola? Oh, you went there? No, by me on the web. It's just Biola, right? Yeah, I think so. www.biola.edu. You know, what's interesting about this list of 12 discoveries is that I put one on the list that was literally just released yesterday. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that one that was released yesterday. It's actually a follow-up of a discovery that we discussed, I think, 2 weeks ago. Was it 2 weeks ago I talked about how Uranus and Neptune interact with the Edgeworth-Kuiper belt of asteroids and comets? Well, the two individuals, Gomez and Morbidelli, that were responsible for that study on Uranus and Neptune and the Kuiper Belt objects, have just announced their latest modeling. And this one actually models the whole history of the early solar system from its birth point up through the first billion years, and it includes Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and then the belt of comets between Mars and Jupiter, and then the Edgeworth-Kuiper belt of comets that now exists beyond the orbit of Neptune and Pluto. But as I mentioned to you 2 weeks ago, these two authors had published a series of papers pointing out that the Edgeworth-Kuiper belt of asteroids and comets originally was much closer to the Sun than it is today. And it's the interaction with Uranus and Neptune that pushed that Kuiper belt out to its current distance. Well, his latest study, and by the way, I got this all written out for you too, so you each get a copy of this. All this neat stuff you can use for your Christmas witnessing. Okay, so this is a paragraph discovery of what happened at a scientific meeting that took place just a couple of weeks ago, and a release of which was announced just yesterday. And this is the meeting of the Division for Planetary Sciences held in Louisville, Kentucky, November 8th and 12th of this year. Once a year, this group gets together to talk about the latest planetary science discoveries. And the highlight of this meeting was Gomez and Morbidelli getting up and presenting their latest model. By the way, the model has not yet been published in a peer-reviewed journal. That will be coming. It's been accepted for publication, but it's not yet been released. But at this meeting, they gave a detailed summary of what's going to show up in the peer-reviewed paper. And what they've done in this one is they've taken it a step past. Remember 2 weeks ago I talked about how the interaction between Jupiter, between Uranus and Neptune and the Edgeworth-Kuiper belt enabled Uranus and Neptune to move farther away from the Sun, to a place where you wouldn't get destructive resonances with Jupiter and Saturn that would disturb the orbit of planet Earth and pull it out of its life support zone. That it not only moved it farther out, it gave it much more circular orbits. And it's critical that the gas giant planets in our solar system, and I'm going to use that term again, what I mean by gas giant is a big planet that's mostly gas. That would be Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. For the stability of life on planet Earth, particularly the long-term stability of life on planet Earth, it's critical that all four of the gas giants be fairly distant from the Sun. If they're any closer, then they will gravitationally disturb the orbit of the Earth. They must have low inclinations, and what I mean by the inclination is you've got the plane of the solar system, and it's important that the gas giants that the plane of their orbits be almost identical to the plane of the solar system. So if you look at Pluto and Mercury, for example, their orbits are tilted relative to the plane of the solar system. And if that were the case with a gas giant, that would disturb the orbit of planet Earth. Earth, by the way, would get disturbed the most of the inner solar system. That's not the case. It's the least disturbed of the inner solar system planets, but they would all be disturbed. Okay, so the inclination must be close to zero, and the eccentricity must be close to zero. And the eccentricity simply refers to how elliptical the orbit is. So it's critical that, actually it's critical that all planets in our solar system have reasonable mass. Anything more massive than Mars have virtually perfectly circular orbits, and that's one of the unusual features of our solar system. It's the only planetary system discovered to date where the planets are all low inclination, low eccentricity, and where none of the gas giants are orbiting close to the sun. So ours is the only planetary system that astronomers have seen that has those characteristics. Those are all characteristics necessary for life. What's interesting about this study, it's so complete. It includes the movement of Jupiter and Saturn, and it finally offers an explanation for what's called the late heavy bombardment. Now I'm going to go to the blackboard and just kind of diagram for you what I mean by this late heavy bombardment.
Thank you. assuming Justin Trump, you're just in orbit of a user, and you have the orbit of that. Now, both of these planets were closer to the sun in the past than they are today. But as they interacted with these planet systems, the planet systems of that size kind of covered space like this. Uranus and Neptune were out here, but much closer to the sun than they are today.
Thank you. distance from the sun. Thank you.
One more thing that comes in the study is that the and the intensity of the light that we call harvest are critical for light assisted long term pressure and also provide the contributors to keep together that the origin of light and light are not the same. We talked about Anthony's food earlier, and one of the things that Anthony's food pointed out is one of the big problems with the natural is the point of light. And we know today that the origin of life in climate earth was sucked into the climate of harvest. And 2.85 million years ago, we thought harvest would be that it would have turned the surface of planet earth into lava several hundred kilometers deep. And it would have turned into a temperature of 2,000 degrees centigrade. And you don't have to do chemistry to realize that if you've got hot lava at 2,000 degrees centigrade, you've got no problem going into the world of chemistry. But just at that point, at that moment, and we can approach it there, it would have been very easy. Thank you.
Most of the moons we see in the solar system formed at the same time the planets did, and by the same means, the condensation of gas, dust, and debris. Except for our moon, and there's also some other exceptions, there are captured moons. When you look at the four gas giants, all four of the gas giants have captured moons, which are basically Kuiper Belt objects that they capture. And that explains why you have some moons that orbit around their planet the wrong way. Okay, yeah, Triton goes around Neptune the wrong way. And it's a captured body. I think they now have identified Titan also as a captured body. Yeah. Not that it goes around the wrong way, because the thing about a captured body is you've got a 50% chance that it could orbit the right way or orbit the wrong way. Depends how it was captured. And so captured bodies are 50% retrograde and 50% prograde. But all the bodies that form with a planet are prograde in their orbit around their planet. And so like the four big moons of Jupiter all form with Jupiter, but Jupiter's got lots of small moons that were captured. Yeah. Bombardment that gives you the whole surface of the Earth at 3,000 degrees of centigrade, and with lava deep about 300 to 600 kilometers, and obviously life's impossible under those conditions. Life chemistry is impossible under those conditions. And notice it takes 50 million years for the late heavy bombardment to end after 3.85 billion years. So the Earth doesn't have a chance to get cool enough for water to form or rocks to form until it's 3.80 billion years old. Now, if you pick up our Origins of Life book on the table there, you'll see that there's a huge amount of evidence that establishes that life was abundant on planet Earth 3.80 billion years ago. And we have a lot of quotes in there by a number of leading agnostics and atheists who are doing Origins of Life research, where they basically concede that the origin of life on planet Earth was instantaneous. The moment that planet Earth had conditions that would allow life to exist, life is there. Yeah. It's everywhere on the planet, and a fairly new set of discoveries shows us that it's not one ancestor. I mean, kind of the naturalistic origin of life model is that out of this soup appeared one bacterium, and that single bacterium gave rise to all life. Well, what we're now discovering is that 3.80 billion years ago, you've got dozens of diverse species of bacteria. You've got photosynthetic bacteria that depends on oxygen, photosynthetic bacteria that doesn't depend on oxygen, and you've got a whole range of chemotrophs and extremophiles and sulfate-reducing bacteria, literally dozens of different species. And as we study it more, it may wind up to be hundreds. That's one reason why there's some enthusiasm about going to the moon, because the moon would actually have a faithful record of Earth's first life. Whereas on planet Earth, you notice that you get a bombardment. To the moon and find the fossils of the early Earth life. Say, how did it get there? Well, you've got these collisions taking place on planet Earth. A lot of those collisions are going to bounce stuff away from planet Earth, and it's going to land on the moon. And in fact, one of my colleagues, Guillermo Gonzalez, calculated that there's about 20,000 kilograms of Earth material for every 100 square kilometers of the moon. And therefore, going to the moon may help us actually identify which species of life were present on the Earth during that time. Yes. Well, that's kind of the main theme. I mean, if you want to get through the Origins of Life book in 5 minutes, just read that early introduction where we say, you know, origin of life from a naturalistic perspective is based on two presuppositions. Number one, there is a vast primordial soup on planet Earth. And number two, that vast primordial soup percolated for at least a billion years. We now know two things. There is no soup ever existing on planet Earth. And we know that definitively from carbon-12 to carbon-13 ratio studies of early carbonaceous material in the Earth. The Earth has never had a prebiotic soup. All we see are postbiotics, not prebiotics. And because of this late heavy bombardment, we now know there's no time. Because you've got life abundant at 3.80 billion years ago, but not until 3.80 billion years ago does the late heavy bombardment subside enough where you're going to get liquid water and rocks to form. It also demonstrates something which I think is becoming more significant in our biblical creation model, namely that the Creator is aggressive in His creation. He creates as early as the laws of physics He established would permit life to exist on planet Earth, and He creates life in great abundance. This to me testifies of how the Creator was working to load the planet with as many biodeposits as possible so that human beings would be able to quickly launch a high-tech, high-affluent society. So it isn't God just, you know, creating life here and there. He's aggressively creating life on planet Earth for as long as a period of time in order that human beings have the richest resources available at their disposal. Well, Guillermo Gonzalez has also given that as another reason why we should go back to the moon. Because what he's been pointing out is Harold Morowitz has calculated, if you're really talking about time, what you realistically need from a naturalistic perspective is 10 to the 100 billion years. That's 100 billion zeros after the 1. So he says a billion years isn't going to make any difference. But we now know it's not a billion years. It's a geological instant in which life shows up on planet Earth. That explains why there's so much enthusiasm from the naturalistic camp to this idea that life fell on planet Earth from outer space, because they realize they can't make it happen on the Earth. It's got to fall from outer space on the Earth. And that's why we devote about a third of our Origins of Life book to pointing out why that hypothesis cannot possibly be correct. That life cannot survive passing through the Earth's atmosphere. It can't survive the radiation that exists in outer space. And you can't put life in a rock, because the rock you would need to protect the life from the heat of entering the Earth's atmosphere and the radiation of outer space would be 2 meters in diameter. And we will calculate in the book how many rocks of that size the planet receives. And a rock the size of my fist visits Earth from somewhere beyond the solar system only once every 10 to 16 years. That's a million times older than the age of the universe, let alone a rock that's 2 meters across. Yes. Yeah, it did fall upon the Earth from an external source, but extraterrestrial, supernatural, transcendent source, yeah. Okay, yeah, this is a good point that you're raising. Things you have to serve, yes. Um, we were involved with another ministry in producing a timeline for them. But we were very careful not to put precise dates on it. Some of these dates are known much more accurately than other dates. And so we were nervous about putting something up on our website where people would come along and say, you know what, you're a little bit off here, need to make adjustments here. So what we try to do in our books on our creation model is give you the order in which things happen, rather than trying to pin down exact dates. And this other ministry especially wanted us to do that for the different species of life on planet Earth, and we had to say, look, there are portions of the history of life on planet Earth where we simply lack accurate dating tools. And so we asked them, please, not to pin us down, because, you know, a typical lay person looking at a chart isn't going to recognize the variation in the accuracy of the dating methods. And where scientists are disputing it and where scientists are not disputing it. They said, let's kind of do the whole thing. We realized we couldn't chart it anymore. So we put all those caveats on it. That kind of destroys the benefit of the chart. But I forget the name of the ministry. There is a link on our website where you can get that chart. And there are some crude charts on our website, like for human origins. And there's a paper you can get from us which kind of outlines the whole history of creation, from the creation of the universe to human beings. And we try to give you some idea of the error bars. It's all in one page. Okay, last question, then we're going to pray. Yeah. Oh, good. Well, that's nice. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting show where a guy plays the role of Jesus Christ and tries to answer people's questions as if he was Jesus himself. And if we had a chance to talk to him, he said, you know, that's really a difficult thing to do. Especially when you get people calling in who don't have the best demeanor. Okay, let's bow. Father in heaven, we thank you that we do live in such an exciting time of new discoveries. Lord, what a blessing to be able to use these new evidences to show our friends, associates, and relatives new reasons to believe in you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Father, I pray during this Christmas season that our own belief in you would strengthen. Lord, to build sanctification within us, that we would be walking more closely with you and through your Holy Spirit being transformed into your character. The Lord also causes us to be sensitive to look for those opportunities when we can share with others this exciting news. And give us the wisdom and the grace, Lord, to guide people around their mental roadblocks and their aspects of rebellion against your authority. Lord, that they may be able to hear these new truths and really have your Spirit work on their hearts to bring them into a right relationship with you. Lord, I pray that each one in this class would come through this season with testimony of how they've been used by you to spread your truth, life, and love. In Jesus' name, amen.